So curious, before we start, this year, as probably everybody knows, we've been exploring the 10 Oxfording pictures, which is a Zen practice, Zen depiction of different stages of the path of practice. I'm just curious, does anybody have no idea what I'm talking about? Like ox, bull, herding, what are we talking about? Anybody not have any idea whatsoever? And fine if so. So everyone's okay. And online, those I can see, I didn't see any hands up. So this month we're at the eighth picture, I believe. And this is the picture that depicts, instead of the usual characters, so instead of the ox herder, instead of the ox, instead of the scene that we've been used to in various configurations, there's simply one calligraphy stroke, right? One circle, sometimes complete, sometimes incomplete. So this is said to be, various interpretations: awakened mind, original mind, a circle of connectedness or togetherness, also a circle of emptiness. So this was an interesting one to kind of come into in the series, right? It's been recognizable until now. But before I go any further, I know Tim and Tori have talked about this, but I just want to give, I'm going to do some honoring of the origins and the tradition out of which this came. So this came out of the Chinese tradition. So I believe it was around the 11th century. The paintings and the verses came a little bit later, right? So the person who the verses are attributed to is Qiuwen Shiwan. If I'm pronouncing that exactly right, but it feels important as we're contemplating to name where this practice originated. And there are pictures, the calligraphy paintings on the website. Those are from actually a Japanese calligrapher, Chikihara Gyokusei, and these were done in 1982, I believe. So, just to mention before we start, that these have been contemplated, practiced with, delved into for centuries, right? These have an ancient tradition. And as I was deciding what would be helpful in terms of a talk tonight, as we have come to this such a simple graphic, actually, I'm wondering, Ken, if you might put the picture up, if you're able to screen share the picture for this month of the Enzo circle. Thank you. He said, give me a moment. I'm putting him on the spot. While he's getting that ready, I'll just say I had the thought. Perhaps this could be one of those talks where it would have been most appropriate had I just sat up here and said nothing, right? Absolutely nothing. Or just had everyone on YouTube maybe watch Thich Nhat Hanh just do one perfectly embodied full calligraphy stroke from beginning to end, right? So very simply, here it is. Okay. So the circle, depending on who the artist is, starts in different places. But it's one complete gesture or movement. So there isn't any editing or refining or changing it. It's one complete movement. So sometimes the circle is, the end doesn't touch the beginning. Sometimes there's a little opening, and sometimes it's more complete. So depending on the artist. But the first thing to recognize perhaps is that this is an expression of awakening, or a moment of an awakened mind, right? This is one expression. And the verses, which we'll talk about, forget both self and ox. So the characters from the previous pictures are no longer at the center. So in the picture before, the ox herder had kind of forgotten the ox. The ox was tamed, and the person was sitting in repose, kind of the mind calmed, quieted, settled. It was a picture of ease and spaciousness. In this picture, it's just a symbol, so an expression of one moment of awakening, right? So rather than saying nothing, and maybe as part of the homework, you can watch Thich Nhat Hanh, just do one beautifully embodied movement, just to express kind of the nature of that free awakened mind. I will help us use the verses and really use this as a contemplation. Okay, so thank you, Ken. I think that's, I just wanted to see the character, and then I have the verses here, so I'll talk about those in a moment. But just to say at first, you know, every time I give a talk, this is not new anymore. It's like I'm kind of destined to live it out in a way, like live out the theme of the talk. And this is probably as it should be. Like I should be like practicing with these themes rather than just spouting off about them, right? So with this one in particular, I've really been wrestling with the ox. I've been wrestling with this theme, feeling the pressure not only about how to talk about emptiness, just like the core teaching, but also how to kind of give appropriate reverence and do justice to a tradition that isn't my root tradition, right? So this tradition, I've studied a bit in the Zen tradition, spent a little time in practice centers and monasteries, but it isn't my tradition. So there felt like there was this a different kind of tension to try to understand and convey with some accuracy. So I was kind of wrestling with this, and rabbit hole of rabbit holes, as the internet can be, noticing that as I was kind of watching different people practice this calligraphy, lo and behold, Google got my algorithm and started sending me ads for Enzo calligraphy paintings for $1,600 a piece. Original little bits of awakening for $1,600, right? So this is when these are the rabbit holes. These are the dead ends that the internet can take us to, right? The height of spiritual materialism. Not only have we forgotten like the finger pointing at the moon or what this represents, but now it's for sale, right? For $2,000. So as I was grappling, this was one potential dead end. I was not tempted to purchase the Enzo. But had I not been a practitioner, maybe, I don't know. Having that on my wall, I don't know. The other rabbit hole, grappling with how different traditions approach, describe, and understand emptiness. Right? So it can mean slightly different things. Our practice around it can be slightly different depending on how we're trained. Even different teachers within one tradition can point a little bit differently. But I knew I had gone a little bit too far when the other day I was looking through somebody's unpublished dissertation about depictions of emptiness in various streams of Buddhism, right? And there was a chart and like, okay, I've gone too far. This is another dead end. So within all of this, one morning I was practicing and I happened to look outside my window, and a lot of these ideas kind of churning around this talk, what to convey, how to convey something that isn't describable in words, and yet words can point to it, said to be ungraspable by the intellect, and yet there are many expressions of things, responses that arise out of that state, that mind. Anyway, grappling with all of this, and I happened to look outside my window and was just staring. And sometimes when I'm really grappling with a talk, I'll kind of invite this kind of immediacy, which is like, okay, let the understanding, let the learning be right here, right now. It's right here. What's happening right here? And at that moment, there was a squirrel who had climbed halfway up a plum tree right outside our window, and had a plum perfectly positioned within its paws, just perfectly held, and was gnawing ferociously at this plum. Just no let up. Just gnawing at the skin, quickly, 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 quickly. And so this fruit underneath was slowly revealing itself. But it was this frenzy, like getting into the fruit of this plum. And then it looked up and saw me. And there was this moment of complete stillness where the squirrel looked me right in the eye. It seemed like it. I don't know what it was perceiving. I looked straight back at it. And it just dropped the plum. Right? Just dropped the plum. But there was this moment where we're both alert, aware of each other, and just completely there in that moment. Huh? Right? And then the spell was broken and it went scurrying after the remains of the plum. But this is what our minds are like. We can be scurrying. We can be busy. We can be even around our noble projects, around practice. We can be kind of gnawing away, right? Trying to get to the fruit. And what this Enzo points to is that there are moments, some are natural, and there are also some pointers in which it can all kind of fall away. Right? The effort, the sense of me doing something, the any notions of practice, the distinction between inside and outside, self and other, attainment and delusion. Right? All of these things can fall away in a moment of full practice. So these dropping away moments in some ways are more common in the Zen tradition. There are wonderful stories of practitioners getting, hit on the head, or there's some jolt and suddenly the whole way that they've been orienting undergoes a shift. So this can happen for us as well. This tradition, the tradition of Theravadan Buddhism, early Buddhism, insight, Western Vipassana tradition, tends to emphasize the practice element a bit more, right? Working to see clearly that which clouds the heart, to free ourselves from what obscures, so that then that clarity and radiance can kind of come shining forward. But our primary job, you know, in this way of looking at it, is to really help clear the mind, help let go of certain patterns of clinging and obscuration, so that these moments of clarity can come forward. So this can seem like a contradiction. It certainly has to me in practice. Is the point to try to see that everything is empty, or to kind of train the gaze on the arising and passing of these things that plague, that constrict, that cloud the heart? And so the answer, I think, to some degree is both. I think it is both, but sometimes these two perspectives can feel a bit at odds. So it's similar to effort in some ways. You know, I've gotten the instruction around effort, beautiful instruction, to practice as though one's hair is on fire, right? As though to bring all of one's mindfulness, intelligence, enthusiasm, wisdom to bear on the moment, as though the afflictions and the things that constrict us are kind of setting us ablaze, and we need to free ourselves from this fire. And so in many times in practice, that is a very helpful perspective and a true way to engage. At other times, I've practiced with the instruction. So this is from the first Sokni Rinpoche, the ancestor of the Tibetan teacher who's alive and offers beautiful teachings right now. So there is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There is nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. There's nothing else to search for. Rest in your own place. So you might not need anything more as a practice instruction, just not to set up a contradiction between these two. Okay, so I'm getting ahead of myself, but here are the verses for the circle of Enzo, or the emptiness awakened mind. Whip, rope, person, and bull, all merge in no thing. All merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors. So I'll read it one more time. And again, just let the words kind of land however they will. Whip, rope, person, and bull all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? Here are the footprints of the ancestors. So I'm going to try to pause more often than usual during this talk, just to give a reminder or a sense that all the teachings are also constructions and pointers, right? And sometimes we can feel ourselves trying to grip the plum like that squirrel, right? As we start to hear the words. So we can recognize that and drop the plum, or we can, the pain of that gripping, or we can recognize that all on their own, the words also kind of evaporate. They disintegrate all on their own. And we're left here with a kind of spacious stillness, right? Alert awareness. So first, how do we reconcile this kind of need for practice, especially with that which obscures our view, and this teaching around all things merging in no thing? So how do we connect those two? The teacher Charlotte Joko Beck is no longer alive, but one of my first Dharma books explained it this way. And I think this is extremely helpful. So she talked about a conversation that happened between called the fifth and the sixth patriarch in the Zen tradition. And much like this circle is said to be an expression of awakening, these two dedicated teachers, practitioners were kind of in line for the throne of who was going to be the head of that lineage. And they were tested by their teacher for who had the true teaching, who has the true understanding of the Dhamma. And the first patriarch said, practice consists of polishing the mirror. So like polishing the mirror of our minds. In other words, removing the dust of our deluded thoughts and actions. When we do this, it can shine. So this was one of the patriarch's answer. So our practice consists of polishing the mirror of our minds. In doing this, our delusions can be purified, they can be cleansed, they can be uprooted, and the mind shines. And the other verse from the other patriarch said, from the very beginning, there is no mirror, there is no mirror stand, there is no mirror to polish, and no place where dust can cling. So this was the one, at least in this tradition, that was accepted. Right. So maybe you can see the similarities to this, right? All of the skillful means are put aside, the whip, the rope, the sense of self and other, sense of practice, and all merge in no thing. So seeing the no thingness of all of it. Okay, so this is Joko Beck's understanding of how these come together. Now, while the verse of the one patriarch was accepted for its understanding, the one of emptiness, the paradox for us is that we have to practice with the verse that was not accepted. We have to polish the mirror. We do have to be aware of our thoughts and actions. We do have to be aware of our false reactions to life. Only by doing so can we see that from the beginning, the bottleneck of fear is an illusion. And it is obvious that we do not have to struggle to rid ourselves of an illusion, but we can't and won't know that unless we relentlessly polish the mirror. Sometimes people say, well, there's nothing that needs to be done. No practicing is necessary. If you see clearly enough, such practice is nonsense. Ah, but we don't see clearly enough. And when we fail to see clearly, we create merry mayhem for ourselves and others. We do have to practice. We do have to polish the mirror until we know in our guts the truth of our life. Then we can see that from the very beginning, nothing was needed. Our life is always open and spacious and fruitful. But let's not fool ourselves about the amount of sincere practice we must do before we see this as clearly as the nose on our face. I'll pause there for a moment. So maybe we can sense a place where both of those have some truth in them. We do need to polish the mirror. It's a wonderful and very kind of profound image. So that reflects back to us our true face. We can't see it without practicing. But if we look even deeper, we can see that the mirror too is empty. The reflection is empty. And any action we undertake arises out of that. Maybe we can feel our way into both of those. Whip, rope, person, and bowl all merge in no thing. This heaven is so vast, no message can stain it. So there are other ways to kind of point to this or approach this. And the second part, this heaven is so vast, no message can stain it, can start to point to the relationship between emptiness and form. So again, if we start searching for emptiness, we can create more strain, right? But we can start to notice this relationship between emptiness and form in this very moment. So I'm reminded one of the movements of the drawing or the painting of the Enzo, Thich Nhat Hanh often will put little phrases with each circle. And one of the phrases that he put right inside that circle is, "This is it. This is it." Not "this is it" as some kind of finish line, right? I'm watching, my husband's an avid cyclist, and we've been watching various bike races this summer. And without fail, as they cross the finish line, hands go up in the air. It's like, "This is it, the moment I've been waiting for," right? So this kind of emptiness is not any kind of finish line. It's not the finish line of accomplishment or ending or complete absence, right? This is it, is when all of our attention comes fully into the present moment. There isn't room for anything else, right? Our past might dissolve behind us. Our projections into the future might also dissolve in front of us. And there's just that fullness of being in the present, empty of clinging, empty of subject, empty of object. Right? Just a moment of pure wakefulness. Say a moment of emptiness, a moment of pure wakefulness. But we can start to notice this dynamic between emptiness and form. So years ago, I lived at Cloud Mountain, a retreat center, and it was a wonderfully kind of enthusiastic time in my early practice where lots of teachers came in and did eccentric things to try to help people understand some of these teachings. And they were from different traditions. And I had a wonderful sense of beginner's mind. I wasn't comparing how this fit with that. And well, this teacher says this, and then that teacher says that. And well, this seems much more right. It was just all new, right? So this is this kind of pristine openness as well. But one teacher, I remember, brought up a big kind of blank sheet, poster board, and drew, I don't know if it was calligraphy or just a Sharpie marker with pen on the big piece of paper, drew a bird in the sky. And then he asked everybody, "Okay, tell me what you see on this piece of paper. What's here? What is this?" And everyone said, "No, I see a bird. I see the image of a bird. I see a bird in the sky." And he said, "Yes, that's true. It is a bird in the sky. But isn't it also a vast empty space with a bird flying through it? Which is the foreground and which is the background, right? Is the bird the primary object of your attention, or are you more aware of the background with the bird flying through it?" Yeah. And we could say with this teaching, are you aware of kind of the relationship between the two? You could say maybe at one point in our practice, we're very attached to the bird being a bird. And then maybe as our practice gets a little bit more open, we're aware of some kind of open space, maybe some experience in which the contents of awareness are known within awareness. We're more aware of that open space. Maybe we even prefer the open space. Huh? But what is the relationship between the two? So, and what is it like to notice that figure ground shift? So often the teachings point to a sense of space, even within, say, the room that we're sitting in this moment. Right? So you might be very focused on me, whether you're here in this room or whether you're at home. You can notice me. Your attention can be on hearing. You can notice the content of the words that I'm saying, your own kind of impression, perception, understanding of those words. You can also notice the knowing of those words. Those words are being registered, known by awareness. In a less visual sense, you might notice just now visually, if you relax your gaze, you might just notice or even be able to feel the space around your body as you're sitting and as you're listening. So the space in the room is a kind of emptiness. The emptiness in the room was here before we walked into it. It will be here when we leave it. We can come into this room and shout the worst profanities ever. And the room, the space in the room will not be fundamentally changed. I can speak the most beautiful, profound wisdom teachings or words of poetry, and the space in the room won't be fundamentally changed by that, right? So this emptiness is one part, one mode of our perception and our knowing. And we might notice the effect that it has when we let ourselves notice it. So it just had 10 family members arrive in my small house. It's a family reunion from very various parts of the world. It's a very important time, joyful time, loud time, in which there was a lot of activity. Our small house is not meant to accommodate this kind of activity. What was an empty house became an extremely full house. When everyone left, there was a tremendous amount of sighing that happened. It was a wonderfully joyful time, intimate, important time. But there was also the kind of emptying out of the activity of the forms that came together in that moment, this form that came together for these moments. So I heard myself just being able to breathe a little bit more easily, to feel the house emptying. So the teacher, Martine Batchelor, who's practiced many years in the Korean Zen tradition, we do a lot of inquiry, says, don't worry about emptiness. Notice the emptying. Okay? Notice when things are emptying. Okay? So this could be taken in a lot of different ways, right? But I noticed in my expression of relief when everyone left that there has grown to be a preference for that more empty space. Love the people, but there's a bit of preference for that empty space. So I can notice the emptying. Notice the spaciousness, but also noticing the relinquishing of my preferences, my introverted, perhaps clinging to what's most comfortable and most familiar. So notice the emptying. But also in daily life, we might be able to turn especially when we're caught. The subtle shift when we're caught in the contents of experience to the space around it, the space in the room. So the space kind of in between things, right? So this is a natural pause. So when the Buddha was speaking to his son, Rahula, he gave various teachings at various times. It wasn't just one teaching. But when he was about 18, his son asked him various aspects to teach him mindfulness of breathing. And rather than starting with the teaching on mindfulness of breathing, he gave this beautiful pointer in which he instructed Rahula to notice different elements. Right? But also to start to notice some of the wider, vaster qualities of our minds. Right? So he went through various elements. Maybe I'll talk a little bit about this next time. But he said, Rahula, develop your meditation in tune or in touch with the earth quality, solidity. When you're developing meditation in tune with the earth, agreeable and disagreeable impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. Just as when people throw what is clean or unclean onto the earth is not horrified, humiliated, or disgusted by it. In the same way, when you're developing meditation in tune with the earth, impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. So it goes through various properties, various capacities. Develop meditation in tune with water, the water element. In tune with fire, in tune with wind, but particularly in tune with space, what I was pointing to tonight. Right? When you're developing meditation in tune with space, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions that have arisen will not stay in charge of your mind. Space is not established anywhere. In the same way, when you're developing your meditation, developing your mind in tune with space, agreeable and disagreeable sensory impressions will not stay in charge of your mind. This is another way we have of attending. So aware of space. So perhaps we can be aware of awareness as a kind of field, right? A field of knowing. So this knowing is what enables us to be aware, to recognize objects as they arise in the present moment's experience, to see them clearly, to see them dissolve. This awareness, this field of knowing, is also spacious. Right? It is open. It is wide. It points to a vast capacity that our minds have to know experience, but to not be changed. And as this sutta says, horrified, disgusted, tarnished by it. So this points to a kind of indestructible quality, a vast quality of mind that might be not something that we're used to tapping into. I don't know about you, but normally I feel quite the impressions of what comes in feel quite strong. It's easy to feel horrified. It's easy to feel disgusted. It's easy to feel bombarded, impressed upon, confined. But this is pointing to a limitless quality of mind that perhaps was never touched, was never affected, was never tarnished, but just remains itself, right? Intrinsically itself, aware, open, spacious. So I think that's probably a good place to take a longer pause for tonight. So why don't we just sit quietly for a moment or two? So in many of the traditions, there are poems or verses, much like these, much like the calligraphy painting, are said to come out of the kind of awakened mind, the mind of emptiness, but also point us back towards it. So the verses of the Therigata, the elder nuns and monks, are some of those. I thought since this comes from the Chinese tradition, I would read one that comes from a nun named Liang Hai, who lived in mid-1800s in China, and this is from a compilation called Daughters of Emptiness. In the one place things merge, through the six they disperse. So in this poem means the six sense doors, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching, and also the mind door, so thinking, conceptualizing. In the one place things merge, through the six they disperse. The evening sun heads west, the moon circles east. There's no point in raising these ready-made koans. Just lie up near the north window with the door open. So thank you everybody for your attention. As expected, I got a little less than halfway, but we have time in a couple of weeks. Next time we'll work a little more closely with the second two verses. How may a snowflake exist in a raging fire? And here are the footprints of the ancestors. So next time, speak a little bit about the aggregates, which is a teaching that many of you might be familiar with. But when we speak about not self in the early Buddhist tradition, we're often speaking about, I won't go into it tonight. we'll leave it unformed for tonight. But the aggregates subject to clinging are how the sense of self gets its glue, okay? What we tend to get stuck to in that open space, naturally, humanly, where we get caught. Yeah. Okay. Speak more about that next time. Would love to hear if there are questions, comments, your own reflections around any of this. Maybe start in the room. Anybody in the? You're all in a room, but in here, friend center. Anybody at home? Oh yeah, Deb.
I feel like this picture is probably the most challenging to date, you know, in this.
Can people hear her? I just want to make sure. Can you hear? Great.
The most challenging to date. And so I realized that right away I'm scribbling instead of drawing, you know, a circle. So, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. I am the squirrel. I think the thing that I'm taking away with me right now, Carrie, is when you said about don't think about emptiness, think about the emptying. And so of all of the phrases and wonderful things that you said today, I think that has just stuck a little bit. Think about the emptying and how potent that is and how mysterious that is. But maybe like a scribble, maybe it's also fairly simple, perhaps. It's just like, you know, the drain in the bottom of the tub. Pull it. And see what happens. And it empties. And so I just wanted to say that. And I love those big Enzos. But I agree with you that $1,600 is way overpriced. Way overpriced for that. So I'm glad that you refrained. It was wise on your part. Yeah. Thank you, though.
Thanks, Deb. Thanks, Deb. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the movement towards, or at least the practice instruction, emptying, gives us a little bit more to do, maybe, but more to notice. Anyway, thanks for your comments, Deb. Iris, hi.
Hi, Kira. Hi, Kira. I think you need to move in because there's a.
Well, mute yourself because it.
Okay.
Thanks. So I appreciated, well, I appreciated your talk very much, and it's wonderful to see you. And, you know, I've heard the story about the patriarchs and the mirrors before. I kind of wanted a more satisfactory ending. I hadn't quite remembered it. And this is back to our tradition, listening to some teachings over this last week from Utejaniya about mirrors, and just, you know, would like your thoughts about the idea of that wisdom awareness is just that mirror and reflects whatever is there. And so we don't, you know, we don't need to polish it. We just need to see what's being reflected for us to begin to understand our mind. And it doesn't exactly speak to emptiness, but I'd just love to hear your comments.
Thanks, Harris. I really appreciate that question because that mirrors a lot of my own questioning as well. Polishing can feel like a busy kind of metaphor, like a lot of doing. And so I think from one perspective, you could say that just being aware of the what arises in that mirror polishes it, you know, that it's the understanding of what it is that arises, how it arises, that that frees us. You know, ultimately it is that seeing, that insight, moment to moment, not as a fixed thing, you know, that we bring, but that clarity of recognition, clear seeing, that's what does the polishing. Right? So that's kind of one view. And I know Utejaniya really kind of holds that kind of relaxed, open awareness, like letting go of efforting, which can be such a helpful teaching, I think, for almost everyone's mind, that, right, that it's already here, that awareness and wisdom will do the work. You don't have to do it. and that's enough. I think there's room also for some kind of grappling at times, right? And so polishing can kind of concoct the idea of like, there's an original sin that I've got to get rid of. I'm stained, you know, I've got to make myself pure. And it's the nature of the mirror to reflect. It's also the nature of the mirror to be affected by dirt and dust and things like that. So it's not so much that we need to like get rid of anything, like some essential problem or flaw with ourselves. But I do think that there is a place for like experimenting and with creativity and with like engagement that for me sometimes feels a lot like wrestling. Like I mentioned, wrestling with the ox. Sometimes I think this could be a whole nother talk, but sometimes it's almost as though we kind of maybe let go too quickly, and it's a bit of a, it can be a bit of a bypass, you know, rather than kind of letting things fully arise and being willing to see, you know, this has to do with investigation too, like how they operate, you know, how they operate. So one of my teachers says there is a place for intelligent grappling, being willing to like wrestle intelligently. So, you know, in the one view is that the hindrances need no antidote. All they need is awareness. They arise and they pass. But I'm not sure where I would be without some genuine cultivation of kindness, goodwill, compassion, and some other skillful means in order to more deeply understand, say, some of the dust on the mirror. So that's a long answer. Thanks. I think the question is about the place of skillful means. Yeah. So, great. Lovely. Any other comments or your own reflections or expressions? Yeah, Kathy.
Yeah, it just came into my mind. Could you say something about efforting or effort and in regard to skillful means as being a not overly worked effortful thing?
So maybe I'll just say, I know we're running a little up to time too, but in reference to all these pictures, we're never with just one picture, right? So we're never just with this picture. And I'm sure Tim and Tweri have talked about this as well, but there was a place for all of the skillful means in earlier pictures. And we're often, this is not a linear progression where suddenly we disappear into emptiness in the eighth. We're always kind of moving through these different pictures at different times, right? So there is a place for skillful means and efforting. There's a place for all of the experiments that we use to kind of help open the mind, help train the mind, help settle the mind. There's a place for all of those. So there is a place for applying, I think, of effort as applying our energy, using kind of whatever we can to experiment. And that's what helps us get to know the terrain that we're dealing with. So there's a place for that kind of efforting where we're using whatever we can to ride the bull, tame the bull. But we also don't stay there. There's a time in which the mind is settled, and there's also a time in which a different level of understanding comes forward. So like the example of if your hair is on fire, it's important to practice, but it is possible to apply ourselves without a lot of aversion or fear. You know, we can actually be very engaged, active, applying our energies, but not moving from habitual conditioning fear. Right. So it's not gripping effort or no effort. It's attuned, appropriate, sensitive effort, right? It's attuned to what's appropriate to the moment based on my own capacities and resources, right? So there's that wonderful kind of ongoing dynamic sensitivity involved in effort. It's not just complete fist or nothing. It's wise effort, right? Intelligent effort. But thank you for that, Kathy, because I forgot to mention kind of the interrelationship between all of the pictures too with this. With this eighth one. Okay. Yeah. Okay, great. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate the engagement. This is useful over the next couple of weeks. And also just want to thank everybody who helped set up for tonight and all of the volunteers who came early to help us be able to be here in person in the flesh together and be able to enable it so that everyone online could participate. I really appreciate all of your efforts. And I look forward to seeing you next week for the forgiveness ceremony. I'll be attending, and in 2 weeks for the follow-up to tonight's talk. So it's really lovely to practice with all of you. See you.